In October 1941, I was recalled from Pearl Harbor to take up the job in charge of combined operations by Mr. Winston Churchill. The very first day I reported to him, he said, "You are to prepare for the invasion of Europe. For unless we can go and land and fight Hitler and beat his forces on land, we shall never win this war. You must devise and design the appliances, the landing craft, and the technique to enable us to effect a landing against opposition and to maintain ourselves there. You must take the most brilliant officers to plan this great operation. You must take bases to use as training establishments where you can train the Navy, Army, and Air Force to work as a single entity. The whole of the south coast of England is a bastion of defense against the invasion of Hitler. You've got to turn it into the springboard for our attack. There are three conditions necessary for a successful invasion. First, obviously, to get ashore against no matter what opposition. Secondly, having got ashore, to stay ashore no matter what the weather conditions. And thirdly, to stop the enemy from building up his forces against you quicker than you can, otherwise he'll throw you back into the sea."
The preoccupation of the army is close support from the air. This is carried out by fighter bombers, and at this period of time, the range of our fighter bombers was very limited. Therefore, since there were not enough aircraft carriers to envisage mounting the Air Force by sea, the Air Force had to operate from bases in the south of England. On the available range, this in turn meant that the invasion area had to be chosen between a point somewhere at the south of Holland, Belgian coast, and what we call the Cherbourg Peninsula. That was the beginning of the story, because this defined the length of coast on which you had to choose the point of assault.
In 1943, when I joined the planning staff for Overlord under General Sir Frederick Morgan, my job at first was to go through the weather statistics of many past years to try to advise on a suitable period in the early summer months of the next year for the Overlord operation. Now, the three services, the Army and the Navy and the Air Force, had all made up their lists of what they needed for success in their part of the operation. The Navy had to have onshore winds not more than force 3 or 4, and they needed good visibility for bombarding from sea to the coastal defenses, and the Air Force had to have very special conditions of cloud, amount and heights and so on. So that when I came to put them all together and select times, I found that they would need to sit about for 120 or 150 years before they got the operation launched.
In 1942, when the planners were planning the invasion, they came to the conclusion that it wouldn't be feasible to have an invasion in which the stores came over the beaches. That was for two reasons. One, that there's a 25-foot rise and fall of tide on the Normandy beaches, and you can only discharge at certain times either side of high tide, so that the amount of time you had for discharge was limited, and therefore the amount of stores you could get over would be limited. And the other was that if there was a storm or bad weather on the beaches, nothing could come ashore. And the prospects of capturing a fortified port was negligible. It was only then that the bright boys, and they were British, entirely British, thought up the idea of an artificial harbour in which they built the pieces in England, towed them 100 miles to their beaches, and put them down piece by piece by piece. And so came about the building of the Mulberry A and Mulberry B. The combined chiefs of staff, that's British and American, said that this project is so vital that it might be described as the crux of the whole operation, and it must not fail, because it was the only way in which we could safeguard the getting of stores to support the invasion.
When we arrived, there in front of us was a huge office block without windows, 60 foot high. We were told to clamber up on top, not knowing at the time or understanding that this lump of concrete was actually floating. And when we got to the top, we found it was just a huge hollow concrete box. It was already tied up to a tug. We thought the tug was tied to it, but it was tied to the tug. And off we went. There were we on top of this thing. There was nothing we could do. We just had to sit there while we were towed along at 4 knots, which isn't very fast. As dawn began to break, we found ourselves in a bay by Dungeness, where we promptly went down inside this concrete box, opened the sluices and sunk it on the sand, and wondered what the hell we were doing, because nobody tells you anything. We soon realised why they asked for volunteers, because these things had never been taken across an ocean. I mean, it was like trying to take a brick across the Thames.
We'd been to meetings in the morning, and he took me to lunch at the In-N-Out Club in Piccadilly. Having been at the meetings, we had our usual black civil service cases, which we had locked with the papers for the meeting, and we put them down under the table, and we had our lunch, and we went back to Norfolk House in St. James's Square. And when I arrived, I found I hadn't got my case. I'll never forget that moment, that I'd left that case in the In-N-Out Club, and it contained the plans of Marlborough, which was the top secret, and if it had been found, it would have given away where we would invade. I hoped the moment that I could die, or at least would be shot instantly at the tower. Not that it would have helped anything, but I really have never forgotten, even to this day as I speak, my feelings of utter horror at that. I rang up the club, and the hall porter answered and said, "Yes, sir, a case was left there, and I've got it in my, hall porter's cubbyhole." And I galloped the whole way from Norfolk House to the In-N-Out Club, and he handed it over to me, and as far as I could know, it was still locked.
Well, the absolutely crucial thing for an invasion is to get the troops across the water, and with that you want landing ships and landing craft, and those we just didn't have. They had to be designed, they had to be built in large quantities at a time when all shipbuilding facilities were required to fight the Battle of the Atlantic. With the support of Mr. Churchill, I managed to get a great many built in England, and when the Americans came in, I got the Americans to really build using our own plans in a really big way. So therefore, the date of the invasion depended on the date on which we could have enough landing ships and landing craft to take the troops over.
I think you can say that as far as the planning was concerned, it was an essentially British operation. Of course, we had American officers with us, and they worked very closely with us. But the original conception of the plan was a British one, and the detailed planning of it was also, I would say, about 90% British. But one had to learn to work with the Americans, and this was not an easy thing. Their methods of planning and conducting war are really terribly different from ours, and one had to learn an entirely different language in order to talk to them than the one one used normally when speaking to one's British colleagues. We were always conscious of how very small our resources were. We knew, for instance, that if we lost a division, it would have been a disaster to us. Whereas the Americans were quite prepared to produce another division. There's an infinite number of divisions in the pipeline. And they regarded people as expendable in a way that we didn't. And not only men, but material. Our resources were very limited. And we simply could not afford to waste things in the way that the Americans could.
Eisenhower came to have a chat with everybody. He was great. The finest general that's ever lived, General Ike. and we formed a hollow square, you know, right round this great big field. And he walked in the middle of the field, and somebody brought him, like, an orange box or something, you know. And he stood in the orange box, and he said, right, old gentlemen, when I say move, like, you know, when I give the signal, all come in and sit down. Now, never mind the officers. The officers will walk in with the men. You'll all come and walk and get down so you can hear what I've got to say, you know. And, of course, that pleased everybody. No bullshit at all about him, you know. But he was immaculate. He was, you just, you're being cut out of chocolate. He said, he'd heard all about you guys have been down in Southampton and living it up. And you know the time has come. You'll be getting on board these ships and you'll fight together alongside each other. And I think it did more to lift the morale, mine, own morale, more than anything else.
We were summoned to a cinema at Portsmouth. And there were about 400 officers there, and the red cap police all around the place. It was all very secret, and we all sat down in this cinema. And then Monty came on, and he told us something about the plan of the invasion, you know. He said, this is what we're going to do. This is what we expect the Germans to do, and this is what I'll do to the Germans, you see. It was terribly inspiring, because here I had been planning my own little corner of the invasion and getting more and more puzzled and not knowing quite where it fitted in. And he suddenly made everything, put everything into perspective, and I can only say that he raised my morale just like that. He was a leader, and I would have followed him to hell.
Why the blinking heck is it to be useless? Some of them never struck a bat, you know. They've had to fetch us all the way back from the Middle East to land here. Haven't we done our share? Been in France, been in the Middle East, been in Sicily. No, come back. Oh, I was that. They didn't like that.
I remember being open mouths at some of the equipment that was being assembled. Part of Pluto, which looked like an enormous bobbin floating about in Southampton water. We didn't know what that was. We saw pieces of Mulberry, some with cranes, some without. Again, we'd no idea what they were for. We saw the crabs, the scorpions, the flails, the other tanks that we had. And it was obvious that we knew we were going very quickly.
We had a visit from General Hobart, who was the 79th Armoured Div, GOC. He gathered everybody round him and said, I have some news for you. You have heard of the Lord Mayor's show. Everybody's heart stopped beating. You know that the people who come afterwards clear up the mess. Well, your job is going to be the very opposite. You're going in front to clear up the mess. You are going to be mine clearers, flails. Nobody had ever heard of them.
In each squadron we had four troops. Each troop contained six Avery assault vehicles, Royal Engineers, and on those Averys were various sort of improvisations for getting over or through whatever obstacles we expected to meet. These included a thing called a fascine, which was a huge bundle of chestnut paling about 10 or 12 feet across, which was held on a little ramp on the front of the tank, could be released and could fill up a ditch. It included an assault bridge which could be dropped and then the tank could go on up it, and so on. It didn't have the ordinary gun. We had a thing called the petard, which was a code name for a spigot mortar, which fired a charge of about 25 pounds of explosive a limited distance. I think about 50 yards was the maximum range. The object of this was to break up concrete, so that if you met a wall, for instance, and you couldn't get over it in any other way, you could smash it down. And we also had a lot of shaped charges called general wades. They each weighed about, I suppose, 25, 30 pounds. And they were shaped charges that could be placed on concrete to smash it up. But you had to get out of the tank to do this. Get out, clamp them onto the concrete, get back in, pull a string, and then there'd be a terrific bang, and hopefully all the concrete would fall to pieces, and you'd climb up it.
I saw enormous tins, enormous piles of compound 219. And this was simply grease with lots of fibre in it, a bit like putty, which you applied around any particular crack or crevice in the Sherman tank. Sherman tanks had an escape hatch in the floor of the tank itself, through which the driver and co-driver could escape. Obviously it wasn't waterproof, so that was where the compound 219 was placed around into the cracks. The engine inspection doors were sealed with compound 219. As you went up the hull, the turret ring was sealed with a type of plastic covering and tape. The gun mantlet was sealed, and of course the gun barrel was sealed. And these ceilings had little explosive charges attached to them, which ran back inside the tank. The theory being, as the tank came off the tank landing craft and rolled up the beach, the gunner or the crew commander inside could activate these charges and blow away the waterproofing membranes that would inhibit the rotation of the turret.
On that Hailing Island exercise, we were landed in water up to our waists. And when the soldiers, the DLI and so on, had marched their 12 miles inland with wet trousers, they were mostly very raw in the crutch. Brigadier Senior, who was still commanding us, decided therefore to issue oilskin trousers, which were issued in those days as part of the anti-gas equipment, to issue these gas trousers, which came over the boots and up to the waist, so that everybody would land with dry trousers and not get all raw and red by the time we had reached our objectives.